Our opening words this morning is a title called Perhaps by Chinese poet Xu Ting, translated by Carolyn Kaiser. Perhaps these thoughts of ours will never find an audience. Perhaps the mistaken road will end in a mistake. Perhaps the lamps we light one at a time will blow out one at a time. Perhaps the candles of our lives will gutter out without lighting a fire to warm us. Perhaps when all the tears have been shed, the earth will be more fertile. Perhaps when we sing praises to the sun will praise us in return. Perhaps these heavy burdens will strengthen our philosophy. Perhaps when we weep for those in misery, we must be silent about miseries of our own. Perhaps because of our irresistible mission, we have no choice. Now I invite you to rise in body or spirit to sing our opening hymn, which is number 199, Precious Lord, Take My Hand. This hymn was one of Martin Luther King Jr.'s most favorite hymns.
Good morning. How are you all? Okay, what is, tomorrow there's no school, and that's a nice thing, but why? Why is there no school? Jed? Martin Luther King Day, and Martin Luther King fought for something. What did he fight for? I'm going to go to Jamie. The right for black people to do the same as white people. And I have a book that predates Martin. That means it came before Martin Luther King's message. And at the end of it, I'm going to ask you to think what Martin Luther King would say about what the two kids did in this book. And this book is called The Other Side by Jacqueline Woodson. And if someone wants to look at the pictures later, I'll have it at Ari. That summer, the fence that stretched through our town seemed bigger. We lived in a yellow house on one side of it. White people lived on the other. And Mama said, "Don't climb over that fence when you play." She said it wasn't safe. That summer, there was a girl who wore a pink sweater. Each morning, she climbed up on that fence and stared over at our side. Sometimes I stared back. She never sat on that fence with anybody. That girl didn't. Once, when we were jumping rope, she asked if she could play. And my friend Sandra said no, without even asking the rest of us. I don't know what I would have said. Maybe yes, maybe no. That summer, everyone and everything on the other side of that fence seemed very far away. When I asked my mama why, she said, "Because that's the way things have always been. Sometimes, when me and Mama went into town, I saw that girl with her mama. She looked sad sometimes, that girl did." "Don't stare," my mama said. "It's not polite." It rained a lot that summer. On rainy days, that girl sat on the fence in a raincoat. She let herself get all wet and acted like she didn't even care. Sometimes I saw her dancing around in puddles, splashing and laughing. Mama wouldn't let me go out in the rain. "That's why I bought you rainy day toys," my mama said. "You stay inside here, where it's warm and safe and dry." But every time it rained, I looked for that girl, and I always found her somewhere near that fence. Someplace in the middle of the summer, the rain stopped. When I walked outside, the grass was damp. The sun was already high up in the sky. I stood there with my hands up in the air. I felt brave that day. I felt free. I got close to the fence, and that girl asked my name. "Clover," I said. "My name's Annie," she said. "Annie Paul." "I live over yonder," she said, "by where you see that laundry. That's my blouse hanging on the line." She smiled then. She had a pretty smile. And then I smiled, and we stood there looking at each other. "It's nice up on this fence," Annie said. "You can see all over." I ran my hand along the fence. I reached up and touched the top of it. "A fence like this was made for sitting on," Annie said. She looked at me sideways. "My mama said I shouldn't go on the other side," I said. "My mama says the same thing, but she never said nothing about sitting on it." "Neither did mine," I said. That summer, me and Annie sat together on that fence, and when Sandra and them looked at me funny, I just made believe I didn't care. Some mornings, my mama watched us. I waited for her to tell me to get down from that fence before I break my neck or something, but she never did. "I see you made a new friend," she said one morning. And I nodded, and Mama smiled. That summer, me and Annie sat on the fence and watched the whole world, wide world around us. One day, Sandra and them were jumping rope near the fence, and we asked if we could play. "I don't care," Sandra said. And when we jumped, Sandra and me were partners the way we used to be. When we were too tired to jump anymore, we all sat up on the fence, all of us in a long line. "Someday, somebody's going to come along and knock this old fence down," Annie said. And I nodded. "Yeah," I said, "someday."
Hi, I'm Greg Jones. I've been coming to First Parish Church since Christmas of 1974. I've held just about every office and volunteer position in church leadership. I'm currently finance committee chair, so you can blame the budget on me. Our kids grew up and formed lifelong relationships in the RE program. As a parent, I can certainly testify that the AYS program, which is now the OWL program, is a lifesaver. Having other respected parents lead a program that helps kids responsibly explore issues of sexuality is wonderful. But that's not the reason I am here to testify to the value of FPC. And I hope that none of you ever gets to share my real reason for supporting this church. You see, in 1991, almost 23 years ago now, our 15-year-old daughter Meg was killed in a bicycle accident. our firstborn child, our only daughter, an amazingly multi-talented person who set the tone for the entire family, the star of our family. In a typical energetic fashion, she and a friend were riding the 12 miles to Neshoba at 6 a.m., filled with enthusiasm. In an instant, her life and the trajectory of our lives was destroyed. The horror of arriving at the accident scene less than a mile from home, the wish-filled trip to Emerson following the ambulance, the confirmation of her death are still incredibly painful to recall. We got to experience every parent's worst nightmare. I don't know how we would have survived if we hadn't been supported by the greater community, and especially by the members of FPC. First, the memorial service organized by our minister at that time, Ralph Galen, truly was a celebration of her life. Ralph spoke with many people and got to know her very well in that short week. Through the testimonies of many people during the 3.5-hour event, we learned a great deal about Meg and how she had impacted the lives of many others, her peers and adults as well. Ralph helped my wife Barbara put together an order of service that showcased Meg's artwork, from serious drawings to doodles in the margins of comical faces peering over walls. Ralph noted that Meg had copied out the Lewis Carroll poem Jabberwocky, so he composed his own version celebrating Meg. That was a real risk on his part. Ralph allowed me to stand in front of the congregation and tell the story of how a wonderful daughter came into our family and was the light of our lives, a light that I desperately wanted to keep on shining. In the days and weeks after the accident, we were total basket cases. I have no idea how our boys got to their soccer games or practices, their band concerts or whatever. Someone from the church drove them. They must have. There were more meals delivered than we could ever eat. We spent hours on our screened-in porch, crying on the shoulders of sympathetic parishioners. The support for us that was organized by First Parish was incredible, an absolute lifeline. Whereas my wife Barbara finds it too difficult to return to regular Sunday services, I come because of the incredible support and the celebration of Meg's life that the memorial service represented. We recently went to the memorial service in an Episcopal church for our grandniece, Georgiana, who died unexpectedly at 14 months old in November. Most of the service had nothing to do with Georgiana, and what did was formulaic and doctrinaire. Perfectly wonderful people proclaiming what I can only apprehend as total nonsense. It made me appreciate Unitarian memorial services, especially as they are done here at First Parish, where you leave with a greater understanding of the life that was lived and is now over. I hope you never get to experience the reason I am committed to supporting First Parish. But I know that First Parish is a powerful institution that can help you through the tough times that life will throw your way. I want to make sure that the institution continues to survive and prosper and to fulfill its mission to help one another.
Our first reading this morning comes from both the prophets Micah and Isaiah. The first one is from Micah chapter 6, verses 6 and 8. With what shall I come before God and bow myself before God on high? God has told you, O mortal, what is good and what does the Lord require of you, but to do justice and to love kindness and to walk humbly with your God. And this from the prophet Isaiah chapter 61. He has sent me to bring good news to the oppressed, to bind up the brokenhearted, to proclaim liberty to the captives and release to the prisoners, to comfort all who mourn, to give them a garland instead of ashes, the oil of gladness instead of mourning, the mantle of praise instead of a faint spirit. They will be called oaks of righteousness. They shall build up the ancient ruins. They shall rise up the former devastations. They shall repair the ruined cities, the devastations of many generations. You shall be named ministers of our God. And then a second reading from the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. And this is from a sermon titled The Drum Major Instinct, preached in February of 1968, just 2 months before his assassination. It's a kind of drum major instinct, the desire to be out front, a desire to lead the parade, a desire to be first. And it's something that runs the whole gamut of life. In our adult lives, we still have it and we really never get by it. We like to do something good, and you know we like to be praised for it. Now, if you don't believe that, you just go on living life. And you will discover very soon that you like to be praised. Everybody likes it, as a matter of fact. And somehow this warm glow that we feel when we are praised or when our name is in print is something of a vitamin A to our ego. Everybody can be great because everybody can serve. You don't have to have a college degree to serve. You don't have to have your subject and your verb agree to serve. You only need a heart full of grace, a soul generated by love, and you can be that servant. And every now and then I think about my own death, and I think about my own funeral. And I don't think of it in a morbid sense. And every now and then I ask myself, what is it that I want to be said? If any of you are around when I have to meet my day, I don't want a long funeral. And if you get someone to deliver the eulogy, tell them not to talk too long. Tell them not to mention that I have a Nobel Peace Prize. That isn't important. Tell them not to remember that I have 300 or 400 other awards. That's not important. Tell them not to mention where I went to school. I'd like for somebody to say that day that Martin Luther King Jr. tried to love somebody. I want you to say that I tried to love and serve humanity. Yes, if you want to say that I was a drum major, say that I was a drum major for justice, for peace, for righteousness, and all of the other shallow things will not matter. I just want to leave a committed life behind. Before I begin, I want to thank your minister, Tom, for inviting me to preach with you and preach and worship with you on this Martin Luther King Day. I currently serve as the sabbatical minister at the Harvard Unitarian Universalist Church. I know you sometimes work with them, so it's wonderful to be here with you this morning. What does the Lord require of you but to do justice and to love kindness and to walk humbly with your God? Yes, if you want to say that I was a drum major, say that I was a drum major for justice. These are prophetic words from the prophets Micah and Martin Luther King Jr. But what does it mean to be prophetic? Who were the prophets? And who are the prophets in this day and age? My advisor in seminary, Gregory Mobley, said this, that prophets were a succession of folk performers who, over the course of 2 centuries, turned God into a poet. Prophets were charged with the mediation of the covenant between Creator and the people of Israel. The health of creation, Mobley writes, the management of chaos depends on the mutual attentiveness and the harmony of these partners. Or to say it another way, God enlists prophets to mediate this dynamic partnership upon which the health of creation depends. Charged with management of the chaos and health of creation. In other words, we sure need prophets now. Prophets don't predict the future, they see through the present. James Luther Adams, a Unitarian Universalist theologian, said this, that he wrote of a prophethood of all believers. He wrote that people think and work together to interpret the signs of the time in light of their faith. It is the church in which all members share the common responsibility to attempt to foresee the consequences of human behavior. By doing justice, we become prophets. Justice in its many forms. It is our duty as a people of faith. Now, of course, tomorrow we observe Martin Luther King Jr. Day, and it's wise to think about how his prophetic words move us. It is the day when we celebrate the birthday and the work of this man who served as the chief voice for nonviolent activism in the civil rights movement. Now, of course, in elementary school and even middle and high school, I always relished this day because it was a day off. It was a day off from school, after all, and what young student doesn't enjoy that? We would usually listen to or later watch the I Have a Dream speech that Martin Luther King Jr., of course, delivered on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial. We would focus on his call for racial equality. We might learn about Rosa Parks, whose actions were some of the first in the Montgomery bus boycott. And then we'd move on. In college, I also began to encounter other works by Martin Luther King. I read the letter from Birmingham Jail, as well as other speeches. But my experience was still just cursory. It was something you would study for a couple of days at the end of January, and then you'd move on. King asked the following questions in a sermon that he delivered at Ebenezer Baptist Church on the Sunday after Christmas in 1952. What did we gain? What is the value of our meeting with Jesus? What is Christmas going to do for us in terms of changed attitudes and better social conditions? After we have sung Joy to the World and O Little Town of Bethlehem, what then? And while King was preaching about what we gain after encountering the Christmas story, I want to take that one step further and say, what do we gain by hearing King's words? After we have sung Precious Lord, Take My Hand, then what? I shared with you excerpts from the sermon, The Drum Major Instinct. In this sermon, King preaches about the concept of the drum major instinct, meaning that need to be in the lead, the need to be ahead and the greatest. In some earlier parts of the sermon, King speaks about how it isn't about having money in your bank account. It's about being a drum major for justice. It's not about how much you can overborrow so that you can have the best cars or houses. It's about being a leader for different causes. In the passage from Micah, we hear the question asked, what do I need to do to be close to the divine? Shall I come with burnt offerings, my firstborn? What? No, the reply comes. Only do justice, love kindness, and walk humbly with your God. Now, this is a relatively easy charge, I think, for who likes to love meanness. So loving kindness is easy, and walking humbly is pretty easy to do as well. Martin Luther King wanted his eulogies not to include his Nobel Peace Prize, but rather he wanted his eulogizers to say that I was a drum major for peace. So being humble is also relatively easy. So why do justice? Because this world, as beautiful, as loving as people are, is ugly, and its people can be cruel as well. As whole as it can be, it's also broken. The Jewish people have a phrase, Tikkun Olam, which means repairing the broken world. Or as Ralph Waldo Emerson said, there is a crack in everything God has made. This is our mission. But how do we do it? First, we need to unite spirituality and our call to social justice. We do that and learn how to do that by coming to church. Do justice. How do we do justice to doing justice? I'll start here. It, first of all, involves taking risks. And at first, that risk is small, but our involvement in social causes changes and evolves, and our personal vulnerability increases. So here is one way that I propose that we can evolve our social justice understandings. The first step is awareness. You see a problem and you know it's wrong, and then perhaps you tell someone else that it's wrong. Now, as I am a millennial, I'm on Facebook and Twitter, and most social action campaigns get stuck here. The term that I've heard and love that describes this is called slacktivism. Slacktivism is a combination of the word slacker and activism. Perhaps you're wearing a button about the cause and little more, or in the Facebook age, you're writing a status about it or sharing a picture or video. It makes you feel good because you're showing the world that you care, but it has little or no practical effect beyond that. At its best, slacktivism is an entry point into further social change, and at its worst, it's social justice stopped in its tracks. Now, a lot of what I'm going to share now is from an organization called EdChange. It's a coalition of educators and activists who are providing professional development on educational equity, creating free resources for others, and modeling a commitment to moving beyond celebrating the joys of diversity towards educating equity in schools and communities. Paul Gorski, the founder of EdChange, takes slacktivism a step further and calls this level of social justice food, festivals, and fun. Awareness is heightened to your celebrating diversity, Gorski writes, though an international fair or a multicultural night or diversity fashion show have the potential to bring people together across difference, they do not have the potential to address injustices such as racism, sexism, classism, or homophobia. Next is the giving stage. We give money to the organizations that we care about. And this is so crucial. I can't emphasize this enough, that organizations need funding. Good intentions do not put food in the ovens at homeless shelters. Funds help with that, as do volunteers. But injustices still exist. Gorski believes that after giving comes individual advocacy. Gorski writes that people whose activism primarily takes this approach empathize deeply for the ways in which injustices affect people at an individual level, particularly the people with whom they have been building a personal relationship. However, they are not quite ready or willing to risk their own privilege by pushing for a systemic change. After this, you have service and volunteerism, which is key because you are involved beyond an individual advocacy level. You're doing the work of social justice, not simply supporting that work philosophically. And finally, there is systemic reform for social justice. This is looking at what structures allow for injustice to happen. Folks at this level are less interested in educating about racism as it exists than with eliminating racism, less interested in celebrating diversity than in transforming institutions for equity and justice, less interested in lifting individual people out of poverty than in demanding the eradication of poverty. I will say that with these different forms of doing justice, this isn't meant as a progression, though it certainly seems like it. One form isn't better than the other. All forms are necessary. The only form of doing justice that's ineffective is the one where you're doing nothing at all. With each step, the doer becomes increasingly vulnerable. I'm not asking you to be unsafe. Gorski is asking us to be risk takers. Everything that's being said in this sermon about doing justice and building a beloved community are saying that we must move beyond this vision of seeing social justice as simply helping someone else. Building the beloved community moves beyond this dominant paradigm of us versus them and moves towards we. Or as a group of Aboriginal activists in Queensland in the 1970s said, if you have come here to help me, you are wasting our time. But if you have come because your liberation is bound up with mine, then let us work together. And so, friends gathered here this morning, I wonder, can we be the co-creators of the beloved community? Can we rebuild ancient cities? Can we all comfort those who mourn? Can we do justice and love kindness and walk humbly with the divine? We can. Everybody can be great because everybody can serve. You only need a heart full of grace, a soul generated by love. You shall be named ministers of our God. Come, build a land, everyone. And now, as we leave this gathering, let us take the light of love out from these walls and into the world and use it to brighten our pathways. And when we need to rest or recharge, be challenged or affirmed, may that light guide us safely back. May we hold the light always, and may the light hold us always. Amen. And go in peace.